better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 18th, 2024, and this is episode 3526 of the Survival Podcast, expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Got a great lineup of experts today. Yesterday, we were in danger of not even doing a show, for expert counsel anyway, because so low on material. I shook of the mighty piker tree with a mighty shake, and many pikers fell forth to the ground with answers for the expert counsel show. Hence, we actually have a couple people who submitted last-minute content, not on today's show, and we actually have one or two extra pieces of content in the bank for next week, so that's always good. What do we have today? Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini in the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights will talk about problems with J.D. Vance's approach to Iran and more on just the overall approach the United States has to Iran. I'll tell you why I'm not really concerned about what J.D. Vance says about Iran at all, nor would I be concerned about what just about any vice presidential candidate says about Iran. I'm concerned about what Donald Trump says about Iran for, well, about the next 4 years, unless the Democrats pull a rabbit out of their hat. And I think they're fixing to throw a rabbit out of the hat, and his name is Joe Biden, but we'll talk about that in my follow-up. Dr. Bones will talk about protecting your health and your pet's health during high heat. Eric Hammond will talk about smart meters. We got this whole smart meter ping pong thing going on. Sean Mills did a segment, and a guy wrote Sean Mills a letter, and Sean Mills responded to it. Now Eric Hammond wants to talk about a smart meter. So I like when this happens. I want expert panel members talking back and forth. Next up, Andy McCann can talk about five pillars to start your fitness program with. And this is for people that are like, I know I should do something. In my head, I'm in shape, but I know I'm not. In fact, it's pretty close to exactly what the gal that wrote this email in said. But how do I start? And I'll have some follow-up on this one, too. Sean Mills will talk about developing a two-tank battery backup system. I don't think that's what it's called, and Sean Mills didn't call it that, and the guy asking the question didn't call it that. And even though I don't think that's what it's called, I called it that. Why did I call it that? Because I need something in a one-line bullet point for the show notes. And it's the only way I know to describe this. You know, like if you had two water tanks and one, they were not directly connected to each other for whatever reason, and you had a valve and you could draw from either one at any given time, you might want to do something similar with batteries. Why? Well, let's say that you had a battery bank and you came by another good group of batteries, but they are different ages and different manufacturers, and if you put them all together in one bank, then the weakest ones will draw down the strongest ones. And you really want to build battery banks from batteries of the same type, made on the, made at the same lot, set up on and start being used on the same day. You really do not want to mix, match, and sub in batteries, because it just, you don't. So Sean will talk about that. Patrick Rohrman did an off-the-cuff segment for us on called Goals, Good Days, Bad Days, and Perseverance. I like this one, so we'll play it today. Nick Ferguson will talk about maintaining a lawn with rabbits. I'll just say that this gentleman, you got 3 acres in Tennessee. You don't have a lawn. You have a pasture. And I'm going to talk about choosing a scope for a 1022 with a lower-end budget. It's really not that low of a budget, but I'm going to go low. And the reason is that the scope that is the best scope for the application is a bit out of his budget. He wants to be under $200. The scope that I would recommend for this application, honestly, is $300. And it shouldn't be. It's what we're left with. See, I've got a problem. I found the perfect scope for the Ruger 1022. I mean, I found a scope years ago that it was like somebody, a design team sat down and somebody put in front of them. Now, at the Redfield team, Redfield doesn't exist anymore, thank you, Leopold, and handed them a 1022 with a set of 1-inch rings on it and said, make a scope for this rifle. And they did. Now, whether they did it that way or not, I don't know. But they made the thing perfect for, you know, the other thing. The scope for the most popular .22 rifle probably in America today. I think Marlin Model 60s have sold more in total, but I think if you measured it on sales in the last 20 years, nothing touches the .1022, really. And I found the scope. And then Leupold bought Redfield, and then Leupold got rid of the Redfield scope, but came out with their own value line as they absorbed Redfield and recreated it and made it a little bit better for a little bit more money. And then, like so often happens, they say, well, we're gonna keep both brands. Well, they didn't. And then they got rid of the value line. And now, you know, it's like a $300 and up scope family. And it's too bad, but it's still the best. But I'm going to give you, like, I think I got five different options, ranging from the one I would recommend if money's not an object, to the best I can do trying to get back to that, to some lower options, including one that's like $40 or $30, I think. And it'll make sense when I do it why I'm coming at it that way. And maybe someone can help me find the replacement for Scope Nirvana. Fortunately, I have several of these scopes on several 22s. And so I'm not in need of one, but I need one to recommend because it's just like somebody took away something perfect, and it sucks. All right. Anyway, so that's what we're going to talk about today. Before we do, up front, I want to let you know about supporting the show today by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Instead of an item of the day for you today, what I have is, you know, it's Prime Days this week, and Anker, A-N-K-E-R, Anker, my favorite value brand of electronics, they have a lot of cool shit really marked down a lot, anywhere from like 20 to like 50% on some of their items. And I have a post out about it today, and there's a link where you can just pull up all the Anker deals. And I will tell you that even some of the really good deals right now, they're not listed as deals. So if you're looking for something that Anker would make, don't be afraid when you get on that page to search Anker's Amazon store for it. But I want to tell you a couple things that are available there today that are really like just stupid smoking good prices. So they have their Anker Life P2 mini wireless earbuds, $24, $23.99. These are like little mini earbuds. They come in a case that recharges them, and they're the ones you stick inside your ear. They're great. I don't like them. Well, what do I mean you don't like them? I gave mine to my kid. I can't use earbuds that go in my ear. They fall out. I don't know why I have weird ears. I have an over-the-ear Spirit X2 set from Anker, but I don't like it anymore. But they have brought out a replacement for them, and they have even better sound. They're normally like $80, and they're on sale for $50 today. They're the Sport X10s. They're awesome. If you, like me, have an issue, and you don't want to wear like earphones, and you like to use Bluetooth earbuds, but when you stick them in your ears and you're out working in the garden, they fall out and get lost in the bean patch, get these things. They're awesome. I wish they still made the Spirit X2s. Those were freaking amazing, and I still use mine every day, but they're just discontinued. There is a really great wireless charger that charges, you know, phones, USB-Cs, all of that, $14. I mean, it's an awesome little charger. Some of their battery backup stuff's on sale. It's just a great time to buy stuff like this if you're an Anker fan like I am. And the reason I'm an Anker fan is they never, ever, 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 ever let me down. And they never let you guys down either. I'm telling you, if one little thing goes wrong about anything I recommend, I hear about it. And if it's common, I hear about it a lot, and I don't recommend it anymore. I have never had a complaint on Anker, and I have been using these guys since like 2018, I think, is when I found the brand. And they're just fantastic. So check that out. And remember, you can always support us no matter what you buy as long as you start your online shopping at tspaz.com. With that, let's hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on their thoughts on some recent comments by J.D. Vance.
And the headline is Trump's VP pick, Vance, says Iran needs to be punched hard. Well, that's great diplomacy, I'll tell you. You know, there's a lot of problems in the world, and if you're sincere in changing it, you stick to principle, and you have an open door for at least a discussion. If people will not discuss and will not talk and aggravate, then some people interpret that's our foreign policy. We do it our way or not, or it won't do it. But acting like a bully does not work.
Yeah, I mean, I think J.D. Vance, I think this was, if not his first interview, one of his first interviews after being named the VP pick by Trump. And I think it just shows that he's, in terms of foreign policy, he's not ready for prime time. You know, we are cautiously optimistic. There's a possibility of good things happening. You know, with Biden's people, there's no possibility of anything good happening. So cautiously optimistic. But this was a dumb interview, and it shows that he doesn't understand the world very well. The idea that he's calling for an all-out war with Iran. Now, that may please some of his donors, his mega donors, like Miriam Adelson. These people who they claim to be Israel first, and a lot of these people in the Republican Party are. But I would say, you know, this is not the world of 10 or 15 years ago. You can't just go around with this cost-free bombast where you're threatening everyone around the world. The world is tired of hearing threats from people like J.D. Vance and the neocons. And the fact of the matter is, if J.D. Vance hits Iran hard, Iran is going to hit Israel hard, and is going to – we've already seen – with the strike a couple of months ago, how they were able to breach the Iron Dome. And that was with very, very small amount of missiles. And they have a lot of missiles. They have very high-tech technology. They're sending technology to Russia. That's how good it is to fight against Ukraine. The people who profess to love Israel in pushing for a war with Iran, they are going to see Israel decimated. The people who actually care about peace are the people who care about places like Israel and want them to live in peace. So Vance is way, way off the mark in this. He needs to assemble a better foreign policy team. My guess is he won't, because you know how it works, Dr. Paul. There are think tanks filled to the brim of so-called experts, the people who have done the same thing year after year after year, even as it fails, 20 years in Afghanistan, another surge in Iraq. We need to occupy Libya. Everything they've touched is gone to garbage, yet somehow they stick around, they slink around, they hang out at the think tanks, they get very, very good salaries. And then when it comes time when a Republican is elected, they will pretend to be the flavor of the day until they get back in power. Boom, there you go. You have the same old dumb policies. And so it's very disappointing, but this is a different era. This is not the era where the U.S. can throw its weight around. The fact of the matter is, you want to put in a lot of China hawks? Well, here's a wake-up call. Here's a rude awakening. If the U.S. starts war with China, we will lose. The U.S. will lose. And not only will we lose the war, but probably lose half the country in a nuclear explosion. Is that really what we want? Aren't there better ways of approaching the world than this kind of absurd bombast and threats?
So I'm not that worried about what J.D. Vance said to say. First of all, I don't vote anyway. Second of all, I don't care who you pick out of the Republican Party. They're going to talk shit about Iran. Who isn't? Who that was a realistic pick for VP wouldn't be throwing tough talk at Iran right now? The answer is no one. Somebody will say some stupid shit like, well, if he would have picked RFK, then we really are in the simulation that Elon Musk thinks we're in then. Okay? Then none of this shit is real and you're in a fucking holodeck on Star Trek. That's how fantasy land. Tulsi Gabbard. Well, first of all, she would talk tough on Iran. Okay? And you're also in the simulation. You might as well say, you know, JFK Jr.'s not really dead and he's going to come in. Oh, and by the way, the retarded QAnons said that. Like, when Trump was knocked out in 2020, that was the thing. By October, him and JFK Jr. were coming because QAnon, or Q, said so through 4chan or some stupid shit, right? So let's talk about what is the purpose of the vice president that you nominate in the modern world? I know if the president dies, he takes over. I understand the constitutional purpose. When you look at a VP candidate, let's say from the 1900s forward, what is the purpose of the vice president when it comes to a president making a selection? And there's only one. To get the presidential candidate elected. That's it. To say things to the base that the POTUS candidate cannot say. That's the purpose. To add to their ability to convert votes. And why did you pick? Why was Vance picked? Because he is an excellent pick to move the undecided vote that decides every election in the Rust Belt. He's got a book, he's got a movie, he's a reformed drug addict, hillbilly or whatever. He was actually never a drug addict, but comes from a drug-addicted family. He's got a great blue-collar story, U.S. Marine, grew up in the Appalachian Mountains, like Ohio, already a stalwart, but, you know, you've got the western part of Virginia. You know, West Virginia's going to go to Republican. Like, that's not a bad play. Pennsylvania, rural PA, not a bad play. Blue-collar Pennsylvania Democrats love J.D. Vance. I know you don't believe that because the TV told you not to, but they do. Michigan, this puts Michigan more into the realm of possibility. If Trump takes Michigan and Pennsylvania, it almost doesn't matter what else happens. Like the bellwether, that spells for everything else. You're looking, again, 1980 Reagan victory style here is what you're looking at. If he's able to take those two states. If he takes, honestly... if he takes Minnesota and Pennsylvania, forget about it. If he takes Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, forget about it. If he takes Virginia, which is actually in play now, I don't care what else you say is going to happen. He's got it. And it's not just a math thing at that. To take Virginia, you're taking Pennsylvania. You take Virginia and Pennsylvania away from Biden and the other things that are going to happen, and he's got it. So this is not about J.D. Vance's freaking foreign policy. This is about Orange Man 2.0. And that's what every VP pick is. Now, I do think Trump does have a VP pick now that's enough not right mired. I mean, he's in a swamp, but he's got like a couple toes in there instead of mired up to his neck. The establishment is not going to see it as an upgrade to have a President Vance. So I think he's put that... that kind of VP buffer between those who will attack him in as well. But I'm not worried about it. And this is my last thing on this. We'll go on to other things other than politics, because I really don't enjoy politics very much. The people shrieking about it, it's not the Democrats. I don't care. The Democrats will shriek about anything. They could have freaking revived George Washington, brought him back from the dead, and they would have said he was a slave owner. Right, they could have revived Mother Teresa, and they would have said she's too religious. God could have sent Jesus back, and they would have said his hair's too long. There is nothing that Donald Trump can do, especially pick a running mate that the Democrats won't attack. So this is meaningless. But the conservatives, what is your choice? You're the ones playing the voting game, not me. You're the ones playing politics, not me. What are you going to do? What are you going to do, vote for RFK? That's a joke. What are you going to do? You're going to talk shit for the next couple of weeks, and you're going to forget about it, and you're going to go vote for Trump. So, again, it's not a thing I'm worried about. I do think that our position around the world, not just the Middle East, should be, if y'all want to fight, go ahead. We're not involved. But that's not going to happen. And I would challenge anybody making this argument, even Dr. Paul. Who would you have picked? That was a possible in the first place. And even Dan McAdams, who wasn't in this segment, who's harder than me on everybody, said least objectionable of the possible. So, anyway, moving on. Let's hear about heat, protecting yourself, and protecting your pets.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the expert council goes like this. Dr. Joe, some say they're used to triple-digit heat in the summer and that we shouldn't be concerned from a medical standpoint. At what point does the summer heat become dangerous for our health? And what about protecting our pets' health, too, from the heat? Well, we're expecting extreme heat in parts of the country, and recently Fox Weather asked me to comment on what you can do to beat the heat and stay safe in what is truly a natural disaster. One which kills, by the way, more people in the U.S. than any other, including hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods. This is despite heat-related emergencies being largely preventable. It's true that people who've lived a long time in hot areas are a little less likely to get heat than somebody maybe who lived in Alaska. But it all comes down to your core body temperature, If you let it get too high, you're in trouble. Now, here's how to stay cool and stay safe in the heat waves ravaging the country. Depending on how much exercise you're doing in the heat, it could be just 10 to 15 minutes before you suffer a heat-related issue. There are three levels of heat-related emergency or hyperthermia: heat cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke. Heat cramps mostly affect the legs and are commonly seen in kids or athletes running around in hot weather. Massage, cooling compresses, and hydration usually helps this go away and not progress to something worse. Now, moderate cases of heat emergencies are called heat exhaustion, and severe cases, heat stroke. Full-blown heat exhaustion is characterized by a rapid pulse, flushing, profuse sweating, headaches, nausea and vomiting, confusion, and a body temperature elevation, maybe up to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if you don't act quickly to treat heat exhaustion, it can take only as long as it takes for your body temperature to go from 105 to 106 degrees. Once the body core goes over 105 degrees, thermoregulation breaks down, and the body's ability to use sweating as a natural temperature regulator fails. This causes a cascade of events which, if left untreated, ends in life-threatening heat stroke. Heat stroke looks like heat exhaustion with a couple of important differences. The patient's skin will be red, hot, and dry due to the inability to sweat, and they will also have altered mental status. Probably they'll be unconscious. Now, if you suspect a heat-related emergency, you need to do a few things. Number one is remove them from the heat source. That is so important. Get them out of the sun. Take off their clothing, drench them with cool water or even ice if available. If you don't have a tub, but you do have a sheet or beach towel, drench it with cool water and wrap them in it. We call that a hyperthermia burrito. If you can't do that, place moist, cold compresses in the neck, armpit, and groin areas. Now, why there? Major blood vessels pass close to the skin in these areas, and cold packs there more efficiently cool the body core. Recent studies by the military, by the way, suggest also that cold packs to the feet and hands may be helpful. Of course, you may think that giving oral fluids would help, but people with heat stroke have altered mental status, as I just mentioned. Oral rehydration is useful to replace fluids lost, but only if the patient is awake and alert. If the patient is not with it, they might swallow the fluid into their airways, and this causes damage to the lungs and puts you in worse shape than when you started. The sad thing is that heat stroke is preventable in most cases. Here's what you can do to prevent heat stroke. First, stay hydrated. Let's say you're hiking. The American Council on Exercise suggests drinking 20 ounces of water well before any serious exertion, such as hiking in the sun, then maybe another 8 ounces shortly before starting. You could also drink sports drinks like Gatorade. During your hike, drink 8 ounces or so every 20 minutes. Finally, add another 8 ounces no more than 30 minutes after you're done. Of course, if you're just lounging in a folding chair, you can drink less. Just stay away from alcohol and caffeine. They can be dehydrating. In addition, you want to wear lightweight, light-colored, loose-fitting clothing and use sunscreen or sunblock and a hat or even an umbrella to deflect the sun's rays. If you get sunburn, you're more likely to overheat. I'm glad you mentioned pets because some owners think their dog or cat is impervious to overheating. It's just not true. They might say that Rover's in the shade in his doghouse. Well, in extreme heat, a doghouse is an oven, not a shelter. You should recognize the signs of heat-related illness in pets. A mildly overheated pet will be panting heavily, show fatigue, be unwilling or unable to exercise or play, and that's mild overheating. A pet that's dangerously overheated could have a temperature above 105 degrees. Once this happens, it can be life-threatening. Symptoms of pet heat stroke would include hyperventilation, dry red gums, thick white salivation, rapid pulse, confusion, weakness, even vomiting. If your pet is mildly overheated, splash some cool water or use cool towels on their body, especially on their neck, belly, armpits, and paws. Don't use freezing cold or ice water, because this can cause their blood vessels to constrict and they might go into shock. You want to bring your pet into a room with air conditioning or position a fan to help them evaporate heat. In mild cases, you can also use cool treats or a toy that you put in the fridge. If you think your dog or other pet is suffering from actual heat stroke, well, that's life-threatening. Place cool, wet towels on their body to cool them down and get them to the vet ASAP. The first thing you can do to protect your pet is to make sure never to leave them in the car, even when you're on a short errand. Schedule your outdoor walks for when it's coolest, like the early morning or evening. This is important also to prevent burns on your dog's paws. Remember, you're protected by your shoes. Your dog isn't. Keep pets inside if you can, and if they must go out, make sure they have access to shade and a breeze. Last thought, in a heat wave, it's important to check on the elderly, the very young, and the infirm regularly and often. These people, or dogs, have more difficulty seeking help, and you might just save a life if you're vigilant. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Good stuff from Bones. A couple add-ons here. Number one, with a pet, when they get into a serious crisis, they're probably not going to drink, and emergency veterinary care is probably necessary unless you have a method of giving. Like if you're an EMT and you have your own fluids or something. And humans, too, will get to a point where they're dehydrated from a heat injury, and you cannot get them to drink, or they can only drink small amounts because they're so nauseated and they can't catch up. And at that point, you need to seek higher level care, which he kind of inferred there. It applies to dogs too. On animals, not just dogs and cats. On animals, because we're not going to bring ducks and chickens and sheep and pigs in the house. The place you have to really use a lot of extra effort when these real high heat events happen is when that animal is anyway confined. Most animals will find a place to cool off if they can go anywhere they want. They're better at it than we are, honestly. They're adapted to it. We have two outside cats, and when the temperature's like this, it's not that we won't bring them in, because we will. They don't really get along with Belle in the house, so we have a big walk-in pantry, and we'll set that up, a little litter box and all, and there's a door that closes that off from the rest of the house. So we'll bring them in there. They mostly do not want to be in there. They do not care. They lay up against the foundation of the house, and I'm like, it must be cooler. So to my thermal gun, it's like a 15-degree drop between where the sun is and the shade, and then it's like another 5 to 8 degrees up on that curb of the house. So I'm talking about right where the wall meets the patio. Like, they'll find a spot. They'll go into the trees. They'll clear leaves and lay flat on the ground. You know, that's why you'll see your dog this time of year. It'll spend a lot more time, if you have tile floor, laying on tile than laying on the carpet. Right? You put the nice bed down for him, and Fluffy doesn't want her bed. Well, that's because Fluffy wants cool tile floors. So, yeah, definitely watch out for the dogs, but really, really watch out for any animal that's in any way confined, even what you don't think of as confined. Like, well, I have a pretty big, you know, coop and run system for my chickens. Make sure that they have enough space and enough thermal regulation opportunity to do something about the heat. Next up, we're going to hear from Eric Hammond, and piling on this long continuing smart meter discussion.
Greetings, Eric Hammond here. I wanted to get in on this conversation Sean Mills was having with the smart meters. So what does this mechanic know about this? Actually, man, this is really in my wheelhouse right now. You know, I lived off-grid 8 years on solar. I work for a utility now as a mechanic, but I recently got invited to basically a two-day think tank on these smart meters. So, you know, one of the biggest concerns when these things came out was, you know, privacy and the data that we're sharing with the utility company. And I just want to put some of that to rest. That man had mentioned it to Sean that, like, they didn't really care as a utility what people were doing. So it's interesting, this think tank that I got invited to, basically the whole premise is that we have been collecting this data for 10 years. And we can look at data from our customers in real time. What do we do with it? Nobody's actually ever stopped to think about what we're going to do with this data, or, you know, practical applications. And I think that's hilarious. So, you know, if you just stop to think like surface level, you know, we're a really large utility company. So we have gas, water, electric, we have power generation. So one of the things, you know, we came up with in this group is like, hey, if your water has been running for 24 hours a day, Why don't we call you and ask you if you're filling up your swimming pool? Because you may just have a busted pipe under your house. Nobody's ever stopped to think about any of this stuff. You know, as some other examples, the one that I presented to the executive leadership team was, hey, let's look at this AMI smart meter data. Let's start with the net metering customers who are selling power back to the grid. And let's go back and see when they installed their systems and see what the output of that system is. And we have it in our records what the output of the system is. And we'll see what they're putting out. And then over time, we can monitor their system and we can look for reduced output. So I know on my solar system here at the house, as I get pollen and dust on the panels, the output of these panels can drop like 60%. It's crazy. It's a huge drop. So we use this AMI data, so over the years we can see, oh, now your system's putting out 80, now it's 70, now it's 60, now you're putting out 50% of what your total should be. So maybe we should create a new revenue service where when you meet a certain threshold, we can come out, we can clean your panels or offer to clean your panels, charge a service fee of, say, $200, $250 to have a guy with a long pipe pressure wash a couple panels, and we can show you what that net gain is going to be where over the course of the rest of the year, you might get $400 worth of power that you can sell to the grid. And, you know, we've actually saved you money. So in the utility's eyes, it's a revenue stream of additional income. But in the customer's eyes, we're really looking out for your best interests and saving you money. And we get to, you know, look better in your eyes. It's a win-win situation. That's kind of some of the things that were brought up. I presented that one. I don't think they're going to do anything with it. It seems like utility companies tend to hate solar. But, you know, just to understand, nobody's actually looked at this data. So your privacy has been secure. And really, right now, we're just looking at best case scenarios to help the customers out. And in this focus group or this think tank, you know, there was probably 7 groups of 10. And there was only one person in each group that had access to this data. So it's not like something I could pull up and look at any point in time. Very few people have access to it. Something to think about. The things they do tend to monitor. So now, instead of an analog meter with this digital meter, they know when your power goes out in real time. So if that meter goes off, they're going to come to your house and they're going to see why your power's out. I think that's a good thing. They also are looking at what they call demand. So not just the power you use, but the power you're pulling at any given time. There is some deceptive marketing to selling demand charges to people. I won't get into that. That's a big, deep rabbit hole. The one thing I do want to bring up about these smart meters is some of the meters got installed wrong in people's meters and they're recording the wrong houses. So let me explain this. I heard over the chatter on the radio once that they dispatched a person to a house that had no power, and when they got there, they found out that the meters had been swapped house to house, and their neighbor's power had actually been cut for not payment, and since it was installed in the wrong meter, it actually cut the power to the wrong house. So basically, in a nutshell, these people have been paying for the wrong house for years. And, you know, thinking, you know, this is a utility that has 200,000 people on it, gas, water, and electric. So, I mean, there's easily 100,000 meters out there. When they went to put these in, you just have a box full of meters with numbers on them, and you're going door to door just installing meters in and recording those numbers and submitting it to the company. So mistakes are going to get made. I asked around, and this is actually seems to be more common of a problem than you would think. So make sure that when you get your bill, you look at the meter number on the bill and you go out to your meter and you make sure that that is actually the meter that's installed in your address. When we had meter readers, this got verified every single month. So the meter reader came to your address. He looked at the meter. He looked at how much you used. He wrote that down and submitted it. Now the meter number and your address only got associated when that meter got installed and never again. So if it's wrong, it's always been wrong. And until something comes up, you're never going to know. So check those meters. I bet with an audience as large as Jack has, there's going to be some people that are going to be affected by this. I'm running short on time, so I'm going to shut it down. If you got any questions, gas, diesel, electric, two-stroke, four-stroke, whatever, mechanical stuff, send them my way. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm not saying no more on smart meters if another panel member has something to say about it, but I think we've beaten this one up pretty hard. But I like this, and I think that panel members should be willing to do this on any subject that you think you can add to, including things I talk about. And including things I talk about, whether it's on a show like an expert counsel show or if it's on another show altogether. And I will also say our expert counsel is made up of some really smart people. And even though they all have their specialties, they're all also pretty good generalists. So it doesn't have to be confined to your area. I mean, Eric doesn't really focus on power and electricity and alternative energy. That's more Sean's wheelhouse. Eric focused more on like auto mechanics and mechanical things. But hey, he knows, bring it on up. So let's keep this going. Next, let's talk about getting started with some fitness training with Andy McCann. And I think the person that wrote in is very honest about their situation, but I'm going to add to it a little bit. I think that what we're really dealing with here is someone hadn't worked out in so long. They just have trouble getting some momentum and getting going. I think Andy gives some great advice. I'll throw a little on top of it at the other side.
Hey, this is Andy McCann coming to you from CrossFit Garage here in Woodstock, Georgia. And I got a question here from Pam from York, PA. She asks, I'm one of those not so healthy and fit preppers. In my mind, I can put on a 30-pound pack and hike 20 miles out of danger, but in reality, I can't. That's deep and honest of you. Where can I start? Where do I start? It seems so overwhelming. And I say this knowing that I've walked down the road of prepping. Help. Okay, so Pam, that is a great question, and man, I admire the the openness, whatever. So I think I would say the easiest thing after doing this for so long is to just start somewhere, get a piece of success under your belt. So do anything, right? But essentially there are five pillars of health and fitness, and I love this guy Ben Bergeron put this together. He reworded some of the things that we all know and think about anyway. So it's a flywheel of success. So if you think of a water wheel, the water pours down the top, it starts to spin it. And once the first thing spins, it fills up the next bucket and keeps spinning, right? And so basically once it started, it's easy to keep going. And they all work together. So you can start anywhere. And quickly, there are eat, sleep, train, think, and connect. And I'm going to go through each of these. I know I only have less than 7 minutes. I'll make a bigger podcast on this on my own channel. But so here it is. First thing I would look at is you can do it, again, one of two ways. Go for the easiest thing to get a first win, or take the thing that's in the most jeopardy. And so you can kind of look at this like Dave Ramsey does the debt snowball. So find your smallest debt so you can have the emotional wins. Or you can do the debt avalanche, which is take the most logical one. Weird thing is, sometimes logic doesn't win, and I hate that. Sometimes getting the small wins under your belt is the way to go. So you need to look at this and categorize it in your own life, but I'll give you an example for each. Okay, so the first one is eat. And in a nutshell, if you're eating out all the time, or if you're not cooking any food, or if you're not eating meats and greens, then this is a problem. And a good way to look at it is just look at how much you're spending on food and where is it going. If you're eating at places that have a drive-through window, then that's probably the easiest place to start changing. Just stop eating there. Okay, next one is sleep or rest, or basically giving yourself downtime. So we really need 8 hours of sleep. You can look at that and say, do I have 8 hours of sleep? If not, I mean, start there, right? Just waste when you start by waking up early, and then it'll make you tired, but go to sleep on time. So a good calibration there is, do I need coffee to stay awake? Do I fall asleep at stop signs, right? So if the answer is yes, then maybe you want to start there. Train. So this is move. Are you doing anything? If you're doing absolutely nothing, here's an easy one. Just go to Target, Walmart, or whatever. Actually, I'll put a link I'll give a link to Jack, and he can put it on there for a step counter. Just get a basic step counter and order it, put it on you, and get 10,000 steps a day, or start with 5,000. So move somewhere, right? That's the train side of it. And a good indication there is if you're doing absolutely nothing, this would be a great place to start. So think. This is mental wellness, and it's a little harder to kind of comprehend, but it really drives down into stress. And so how stressed are you? Are you worried or anxious all the time? Then, man, maybe some of the CBDs that Jack talks about is the way to go. Like, start something down that path. Or you could do that box breathing, right? The next one is connect. And that's your social connections. They have found the people that live the longest actually have the deepest connections. So out of all the people, when they go to the top of the top, or the best of the best of the best, of the longest lived people, it comes down to they had the best social connections. And I think an easy way to look at this, and you should have this if you're in that prepping community, is can you call three people and say, I need your help, and they'll be there. If you don't have three people you can call and say, I need your help, then I would start there. And the connect and the social side of it could be as easy as go to the thing and do the what, right? So if you're in a prepping group, or there is no group, start a group. And as Jack talks about, don't call it prepping group. Say, hey, we're going to watch the Wolverines. What was that? Red Dawn. We're going to watch Red Dawn at such and such. Come over and check it out, right? Or maybe there's a local bar that does trivia night, and one of the trivia nights is focused around something you like, right? So find a place, go to a thing that has people interacting in a way that you like, and then dive into those people. Now, here's a weird thing on the social connection. You can't expect people to give to you unless you give to them. So you really need to be willing to say, hey, if you need help, just call me. I will be there. And then actually mean it, and maybe even show up sometimes when they're not asked. So I'm 50, and at this age, I'm seeing people pass away, and I'm seeing, unfortunately, their kids are graduating, and some kids, when they turn 18, they think they're immortal, and it's just stupid crap happens. Anyway, my point in this is this. People will say, hey, I'm praying for you, or I'm thinking thoughts for you, but I don't do that anymore. I actually will text them or call them or whatever and say, hey, I have a truck and a strong back. What can I do for you that needs to be done? Because action, I mean, that's that connection I'm offering. I'm willing, right? So sometimes you have to be first. But I would start with those things. And you could take it one of two ways. Go for easy wins, which I actually recommend, even though that's not me, versus find the thing that's the worst. Now, I know you're thinking, well, the worst, wouldn't it have the best change? Yes, but sometimes stacking up the easy wins is the emotional or the psychological thrust that you need to get going. Jack could probably talk a lot about this. He's really good on that whole psychology side. I am not. I when people are like, hey, how do I get off of sugar? I usually tell them, stop eating sugar. I know it's a little bit more complicated than that, but I'm a very one and zero type of guy. So these are the five pillars of health and fitness: eat, sleep, train, think, and connect. And I think that's awesome that you realize what's inside you and what's not going on, and that you're willing to take the first step, pun intended, to fix it. It doesn't have to be hard. It just has to be something. And hey, Pam, if you really need some help and you want more opportunity to chat, email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. Guys, I also take this content, the ones I usually give to Jack from your questions, and build a whole episode on our own channel for that. So you can search us there, either CrossFit Garage, or it's Fitness, Food, and Finances, or just look for me, Andy McCann. You'll find us there. All right, guys, take care.
Well, it's probably past time for us to do a show that's really on mental motivation. The mind drives the body, and the body drives the mind. And so, at some point, if you will start taking positive actions, you will think better. But the hard part is, when you're doing nothing, and I think that's what's happening here in this situation, when you're not doing anything, you have to have the mental capacity to force the physical action first. So maybe we'll talk about building up that positive mental state that drives good decisions and proactive actions in your life. But if you can just make that happen for yourself a tiny ass bit, I'm going to give you one word. And he mentioned it. But I'm going to give you one word. And if you're doing nothing, I want you to start doing this one word right now. Like right now, like maybe not this second, you're at work and you're not allowed to do it, so you have to not get fired. But I mean, like today, I want you to take some action. Walk, 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 freaking walk. And I will put a link to a pedometer in the show notes for you, because Andy mentioned it. But you don't need one, because most of you have one and you don't know that you have one. You have a phone. A smartphone. And that smartphone, like Apple has a native app called Health. And the only problem with it is they keep changing it. And wherever you can see how many steps you've taken and break it to miles and individual steps, and all, they keep moving it around and fucking with it. They cannot leave it alone. But it works really good, and it gives you things like climbing steps and elevation changes and stuff like that. The health app is pretty solid. I'm not an Android user, so I don't know what they have, but I bet they have something else. There's also one, you can earn Bitcoin by walking. It's called Smiles, S-M-I-L-E-S, and they do have a referral program, so if you don't mind, go by the show notes today, and under Andy's bullet point, which says 5 pillars to start your fitness program, you'll see Get the Smiles app, earn Bitcoin by walking. Just click that, install that app. Just go pull up episode 3526, click that link, and I use this app all the time. You don't have to even really think about it. If you're a power walker, there's actually like leaderboards and shit like that. I don't really care about any of that. But it helps you keep track of your walking, and you get a little bit of some sats. And you even can spin a wheel once a day, and you don't win much. You win like one or two sats, and sometimes you get none. But it's more sats. And instead of paying for something to keep track of your steps, something will pay you to keep track of your steps. I'm sure they're tracking you and shit, but if they want to track me making laps around my property, they're welcome to do that. So it's up to you if you want to use those kind of apps or not. If you don't, then yeah, get a pedometer. But walk. And set a goal. Like, and if you haven't done anything for a while, don't be intimidated by having to set a big goal. You know, set an initial goal to be something like, I'm going to walk a quarter mile. I'm going to walk a half a mile. Whatever it is. I don't care if it's 200 yards. Well, that's not enough. It's not enough long term. I'm talking about a person that needs to get in motion. And whatever that distance is you walk today, you can walk it tomorrow, and you can walk it for a week, and then you can double it. And then you can double it again until you get up to where you're walking a couple miles a day. Just do that. It will if you will walk 1 to 2 miles a day, and I don't mean you end up with 1 to 2 miles because you walk around the office and shit. Like, you walk 1 to 2 miles a day plus whatever else happens. You get your carbs under 100 carbs. You stop eating freaking seed oils and anything with high fructose corn syrup and any multisyllabic ingredients. And under 100 carbs is not low carb. It's not keto. It's not even freaking Atkins. Okay? I'm just saying, good quality food and take a walk. Your life will be better for it. I promise you. And then the world is your oyster. Then you can decide, I want to go carnivore, I want to go keto, like you get inspired by results, and you start pushing for more. Or you can say, I'm going to start lifting weights, or I'm going to start going to the gym, or I'm going to take a Tai Chi class, or a Kajang class, or I'm going to take a yoga class, whatever it is. I ain't going to do any of those last ones, but if it's what works for you, what works for you. But you got to get in motion. Move first, and then you will move more. Let's talk about battery banks now with Sean Mills.
Hey everybody, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got an expert panel question coming in from Eric. Eric says, I have 8 Battleborn batteries, and I am adding 8 Lightime batteries to a 12-volt solar system. My plan was to install a 3-position switch to use either the Battleborn or the Lightime separately. My question is, how do I install the shunts? Battleborn has one, and Lightime has one. Will they combine? Okay, so first of all, for those of you that don't know, a shunt is just a measurement tool that you put on the negative side of your battery bank or battery itself, and it measures the current flow into and out of the battery and the voltage. So it's a good way to kind of monitor the state of charge of the battery. And essentially what happens is the monitors that go with these shunts, when they essentially identify what 100% looks like from a voltage standpoint, then they estimate the state of charge of the battery bank from that point going forward. So personally, I prefer lithium batteries with a built-in BMS system that I can either attach to with a separate monitor or with my phone through an app. But some of the battery companies don't have those, so they use additional components that you buy called shunts and monitors to get that same information. A lot of times you'll see these in an RV, next to the charger, you'll have a little battery voltage
meter, and that is just the readout from a shunt. So let's talk about this specific system. If you're going to put a three-way switch on, I would put that on the positive terminal. So essentially you have your wire, your positive wire and your negative wire from the battery. And the assumption here, since you have eight of each, is that you're utilizing a bus bar so that all of the positives go to one spot, all the negatives go to one spot. And so you would put the three-way switch on the positive side and attach both of your individual battery banks to that switch. So you could select one or the other or neither. That's what the third of the three ways is. And then you would put your negative. So you have all eight of your negative batteries going to a bus bar, all eight of your Battleborne batteries going to a bus bar, all eight of your Lifetime batteries going to a bus bar. And then from those two negatives, you would go off to those individual shunts. And then essentially you would combine those at the load slash inverter, however that system is set up. And so that allows you to have two parallel paths for your energy flow. One goes through, you know, switch position one and through one of your shunts to the load. And then when you're in switch position two, it just goes through the other shunt. And so that's how I would have that set up. Since you're already putting the switch in and you're going to only be using one of the banks or the other one, you don't really have to worry about whether or not those batteries have the same charging characteristics. In the event that you are going to combine these battery banks and use them both at the same time, the big key there would be to make sure that your voltage requirements for charging are the same for the two battery banks. So you wouldn't want one battery bank that's got a charging voltage of, say, 14.8 volts plus or minus 2 volts, and the other one that's got one that's 14.2 volts plus or minus 2 volts. Because what will happen is whichever one is the lower one, that will be the maximum voltage you'll see across the system. And so the higher requirements of the, you know, battery bank B, for example, would never be reached. So battery and because specifically because lithium iron phosphate batteries have a very flat charging curve. So they're like, if you look at the charging curve on a graph, it's almost vertical up to about 5%, and then it's almost horizontal out to about 95%, and then from 95 to 100%, it's kind of vertical again. And so from a voltage standpoint, the, you know, the battery at 5% and at 95%, there's not a very wide range on the voltage side. And so you can imagine if I've got a battery that requires 14.8 volts to get to 100% attached to a battery that is 14.4. Well, when I get to 14.4, battery one is at 100%. Battery two may only be at like 30 or 20 or 10. And so that's why you don't want to combine battery banks that have different voltage characteristics without doing exactly what you're talking about, which is isolating one from the other with the switch. And then the last thing I'll mention is that you do want to make sure that when you're operating that switch, you're not under a heavy load, unless it's a spring-loaded switch. So a spring-loaded switch pulls the contacts apart very quickly, and that prevents arcing. Most of the switches you can just get like off of Amazon do not do that. They're just kind of like gates. And so you don't want to do that under a heavy load, or you'll have arcing inside the switch, which will make the switch not last as long and could potentially cause, you know, fire issues down the road. So just a couple thoughts. Great question, Eric. And if you guys get some more questions in the Jack, I'll get them answered. I've got one more to answer at this point, and then I will be out of questions in my queue currently. All right, guys. Well, thanks, and have a great day.
It's the exact kind of complex question as to why I have an expert counsel in the first place. There's a lot of answers I could give a pretty good answer to, and that wasn't one of them. So thank you, Sean. Let's move on, and we're going to hear from Patrick Royman. I like this segment. It's not really about knives or blades or anything like that. But Patrick, you know, is a business owner. He's also a father of a big family. And, you know, when you are in a lot of different situations, entrepreneurship, taking care of a big family and all, you've got to have certain things. And those things include goals and the ability to get through both good and bad days with perseverance. So that's what Patrick's going to talk about. I think it's a good little near the end of the week lift in our mental state. So let's go, Patrick.
Hey guys, this is Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Counsel segment of the week. This week we're going to talk about some things like goals, work, good days, bad days, perseverance, and how that all ties in with making knives. It's a little bit after 11 o'clock and I'm here racking my brain trying to come up with some content for you guys, thinking about what to talk about. Now, anyone that knows me knows that I like to talk. I don't like to waste people's time or talk about meaningless stuff. It's a struggle for me to record these. I want to make sure that it's bringing you guys value and it's worthwhile and you're not just skipping over that silly knife guy segment. So if you have any ideas, be sure to send your questions to me and I'll do my best to keep bringing valuable content to you. So what does this have to do with making knives? Well, this week I had a frustrating day. I was trying to do a custom knife for somebody. Sometimes some of the things that seem like it'd be the simplest task turn into a mountain, you know? So just the struggle of trying to get something done. So I was going to laser a custom logo on this knife for somebody, and he sends me over the artwork. Great, this will be a piece of cake. Long story short, it ended up taking half the day just to put a logo on a knife for somebody. And it's days like that that I just wish that more people would see and understand, because a lot of times all we see is people's successes. You know, I was thinking about it this week, and it's like you watch somebody do something like run a 4-hour marathon or a 2-hour marathon, and they make it look so easy. And what you don't see is the long nights, all of the work that they put in to make it look easy, to get to that point. And many times it's not weeks of work, it's not months of work, it's a lifetime pursuit of setting goals and knocking them out. I set a goal for myself to actually attempt to run a 4-hour marathon, and I've been working at that goal. By the time it's all said and done, I may or may not make the goal, but it's going to take years. But making those decisions, putting in the work, getting those milestones accomplished is what helps you accomplish these goals. So sometimes you're going to have good days, you're going to have bad days, but you got to have perseverance. So that's kind of what I want to talk to you about this week, is when you set goals that are going to take you years to accomplish. You know, with my knife making journey, as I look back, there was many times that I thought if I did this or if I did that, you know, I would be successful. And you realize over the years, after meeting different people and seeing people who have succeeded, it wasn't just that one time that they had a stroke of luck or something happened. Most of the time when you see people who are successful, you look back over the years and you will see many times that they have done things to get to the point of where they are. I hope this has been encouraging to you. What are your goals? What are you doing to achieve those goals? And are you putting in the work? So this has been Patrick with MT Knives. Thank you for sticking around. And if you have some questions, be sure to shoot them over to me, and I'll do my best to share with you what little wisdom I have. Thank you. Have a good day.
Interesting to me that ties in pretty well with Andy's segment and my follow-up on getting started with getting yourself in better shape. All of these things that we want to do that are positive in our lives are the same way. First, you need a mental decision to do them. Then you need to gain movement. And then from movement, we gain momentum. And from momentum, we gain the ability to do even more. And it's just the way of the world. And the interesting thing is that it takes about 20 days of doing something consistently where it becomes a habit. And when it comes to physical fitness, it takes about 30 to 40 days of doing it consistently to where you literally miss it when you don't do it. Even if you're not excited about it when you do it, there's a certain endorphin component to it at the other side that when you don't have it, you start to miss it, kind of like you miss a substance. And in this case, it's a natural substance. It is endorphins. It isn't made inside your body. But then there's only one way to make it happen, and that is always doing things that are good for you. So just keep that in mind when you're working on your perseverance and working through those good and bad days. And one of the good things about adding some fitness component to your life is even on a bad day, you have that to do and that to feel good about. All right, let's talk about rabbits with Nick Ferguson, and then we'll talk about 22 rifle scopes with me.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Nick on using rabbits to mow lawn. And no, it's not myself. Jack, my question is for Nick F. Is it possible or a good idea to use rabbits to keep some of the lawn mowed? I have 3 acres in West Tennessee, and I don't want to spend all my free time mechanically mowing the yard. That's a good idea. Would rabbits be a good way to keep the grass down, then use the rabbits as a source of food for me and my LGD? My concerns are that rabbits could dig under any pen I put them in that has ground contact, and that it would be much harder to collect their droppings to use as fertilizer. Any thoughts you would have would be appreciative. Thank you. Well, I would just leave the droppings there. If you are tractoring them like that, then I would just leave them on the lawn as fertilization to build the fertility and health of your soil. So I wouldn't try to collect droppings from there. You collect your droppings from your breeder pens, and your breeder pens are generally safe somewhere else. So I would say absolutely, it works great as long as you're okay with kind of a patchy, uneven lawn and you're not looking for that, you know, manicured look. And you're willing to move the rabbits at least once a day, preferably twice, once in the morning and once in the evening. If you try to use a netting situation like you were kind of talking about, you're definitely going to have predator issues, so that's not what I'd suggest. It can work, but you will definitely have a very patchy grass area with holes all over the place from where they dig dens. I can almost guarantee hawks, owls, foxes, domestic dogs will obliterate the stock. You're a lot more likely to have problems with coccidiosis and other soil-borne diseases because we're talking about domestic rabbits that don't have the same kind of resistances to those diseases as wild rabbits. And even wild rabbits are just full of diseases and pests and worms and stuff, so I don't like soil contact for rabbits. I know some people do the whole colony thing. I've seen it work. I've seen it be a huge failure also. So what I suggest and what I've done in the past is to make essentially a chicken tractor. The only difference I'd make to a Salatin-type chicken tractor or any other would be to add some untreated wood runners or metal pipe tubing under the tractor, you know, going in the direction of travel with like 1 inch by 1 inch by half inch rabbit cage wire on top of the runner. So that's going to be like the floor type stuff or the baby saver type wire. So it's going to be rectangular mesh pattern. And you want to put the long dimension of the mesh in the direction of travel as well, so that when that grass is laid over, it will try and pop up into the long dimension of your fence wire, and it will pop into the area where the rabbits are a lot easier and make it easier for them to grab with their teeth and their lips, and they'll be able to pull it up through and trim it off. And I'd space those runners or laths at close enough intervals that you won't have significant bowing problems, and just make sure that it's not too tall. Basically, whatever height you want them to maintain, you set the floor at that height. So it might be 3 to 4 inches off the ground to let the grass recover well. So that could be like a 3-inch piece of PVC on either side to kind of be kind of like the pontoons, if you will. You can always heat that PVC up on the ends to make bowed runners like a sled. And then you could put like 1x3 boards or 1x4 boards as your laths in between, and then just kind of cap it with something to give it a little bit of dimensional stability. But anyways, they're going to pull it through that floor and then trim it at the floor height. My old rabbit tractor was like 4 foot wide and 8 foot long. Pretty close to that. I think it was 8 foot long. And I pulled it between the rows of willow trees, and the rabbits would trim the sides of the willows while mowing the grass and weeds between the row. It worked like a charm. I moved them like 2 times daily. I never had coccidiosis issues. I used that for my grow-out meat rabbits. The breeders stayed in their own breeder cages in the chicken barn. Yeah, and then on the laths, I forgot to add what you'll do to give it kind of some lateral stability so those laths aren't kind of just bowing all over the place and pulling apart is you will want to actually staple the fence down onto the boards from, you know, like from inside the cage down. And that'll give it stability laterally. And then you'll have your direction of travel stability by end cap boards. And again, I would leave those end cap boards a little bit high and then bevel the ends of your boards so that they're not gouging into grass and everything, so that they're kind of smooth. Yeah, hope that helps. And to everybody listening, remember, I'm hoping to get that trip to North Dakota scheduled in the next couple of weeks for early August. Things have just kind of been pushing us back a little bit with our scheduling. So if you're in the middle states between North Dakota and Louisiana, I still have slots open for on my way up there and back. Just shoot me an email with consulting in the subject line to nick@homegrownliberty.com. Do good things.
Good advice from Nick on rabbits. I won't say much on that because we have 3 rabbit interviews coming up. 2 folks straight out of the audience that heeded the call that I wanted to talk about rabbits because we haven't done it for a while, and one who's turned out to be a longtime listener, but I actually connected with him via Noster. And he's doing colony rabbits, and I'm excited to finally get somebody on doing colony rabbits. I've been trying to do that a long time. There's quite a few people that do it. I don't know, maybe there's something unique about people that do it or something, kind of like it's hard to get a mushroom spawn MSB discount vendor. Like, I don't know what their deal is. They don't get it. But all the colony rabbit people tell me I don't know enough to be a subject matter expert or something like that. I'm like, how long have you been doing it? 10 years? Yeah, you do. Come, no, they won't do it. This guy, he's like, yeah, I'm excited to come on. So we'll be bringing more rabbit content to you soon. Let's talk about something you could use to make bunnies dead. We're not talking about being a bunny boiler. I'm not big on boiling bunnies. Some of y'all get that joke. Some of you don't. But that's not the way to cook a bunny. Bunnies don't need to be boiled. They need to be sautéed or fricasseed. Anyway, Jerry emailed me a question. He said, what scope would you recommend for someone with 57-year-old eyes? Let me hold you there, Jerry. I'm in my 50s myself. We don't need to be making excuses about our eyes in order to have optics on our rifles. Everybody does this. Stop doing it. All you old guys like me and older than me and a little bit younger than me, my eyes aren't as good as they get. Optics are good. We do not need an excuse to have optics. I just had to say it. He says, I need to kill coons and other things, get into my chickens in the range of 1 foot in a trap. Well, it doesn't matter then. And a max of about 100 foot. So that's a 35-yard shot, roughly. I'm planning on getting a Ruger 10/22 for easy loading at 6:30 in the morning and want to know what scope you would recommend for this application. I have a Marlin Model 60 with a 4.32 scope on it. It was given to me. I don't like how long it takes to load the tube magazine. I think the scope has too much magnification. It's hard to find what I need to shoot just by looking through the scope. So here's the thing. I'm not going to be recommending much today that's lower magnification than 4. Though I do have... Well, I am. I got all but one scope or lower magnification than 4, so I don't know what I'm talking about there, I guess. What I'm going to say is a 4-power mag is not what you need to be worried about at 100-foot range. You know, you're looking at, again, 10 to 30 yards. If you can't see what you're looking at any kind of range where you would use a scope, then the scope is probably not the problem, unless you have like a 16x with a very narrow field of view at that close range. A 4x scope is what I ran around with on a 22 from the time I was 13 years old until I joined the Army. I spent more time in the woods with an old bolt-action Marlin 25 with a 4-power old-school Weaver scope on it than I probably did studying. I mean, I when that Weaver scope, it was old as shit when I found it, and it did tap out after about 2 years of rough use, and I put like a straight plain Jane 4 power Tasco on there, and that was fine too. I find people that have this issue are the kind of people that look in the scope and then find the target. So that is a skills development thing, and even in your 50s, you're not too old to develop skills. And so what this requires is learning to look at the target and act as though a rod is going from the target into the pupil of your shooting eye, your dominant eye, through the back of your head, and your head won't move, and the rifle comes up into position and the head never moves. That is how to properly shoulder a scoped rifle. If you're an MSB member, there's some very old videos of me giving some drills that include how to do this. I would recommend that you look into them. And I might have even made those public all those years ago. And in fact, I'll check my YouTube channel. Maybe those, I think I did make those public because I remember people talking shit about me and I'm about getting my elbow blown off or something when I'm talking about sporting form, not tactical form. But that is the biggest problem I see. People looking through the scope and trying to find the target. That is wrong. I hate to put somebody down, especially a grown-ass man. And I'm not putting you down. I'm just saying there are right ways and wrong ways to do things. And if you're going to be effective with a scoped rifle, you need to treat a scope like iron sights. We do not line the front post up with the buckhorn sight in the back of an iron sight and then track the rifle to the target. We bring the, like you got to start shooting a rifle more like a shotgun. You create the line of sight between your eyes and the target, and you bring the weapon in between. You do that, I promise you, four power is not too powerful, and a couple feet away in a trap, you don't need your scope. Right? Yeah, that. Honestly, I'm going to say something here you might get mad at me for, Jerry. Okay? You don't need a scope. You need glasses. A 30-yard shot with iron sights, I don't care if you're 57, if you could see, you could make that shot. I'm not saying not to get a scope. I'm saying a scope will not fix an issue here. But what it will do, and this is one of the really great uses of scope at these intermediate ranges, 25, 35 yards, is if that thing is behind something and you're looking for a shot to get through, that's where they really excel. Now, what I want to do, if you're gonna get one of the best rimfire options on the planet, a 10-22, and you're going to put a scope on it, it might as well be something that does more than just shoots raccoons at 20 feet. Okay? Now, maybe someone out there can help me with this, because I asked him what his budget was, and he said sub 200 is better than going up to 300 plus. The problem is, I know the only scope still made today that I can find that is the scope for this weapon. Okay? For the 10-22, and really any 22 rifle. Any 22 rifle. And that is the Leupold VX Freedom 2x7x33mm. 2x7x33. This scope is all that remains as far as the best scope ever made. And here's the lineage in this. Redfield made a scope. I can't remember what the name of it was. I have like two or three of them. It was exactly this scope, and it was about $160 brand new, street price, every day of the week. Almost like 5 years ago now, Leupold bought Redfield. They maintained the line for a while, and then they took Redfield's kind of mid-tier value line of scopes, was the first casualty of this merger, and they got rid of it. At the same time, they brought in, and I don't remember what it was called now, I'm sitting here looking at one on my 10-22, I could get up and go over there and read it, but just trust me, Leupold came out with a value line of their own that's since been discontinued, and in that value line they absorbed the configuration of that Redfield almost 100%. They also introduced this model, the VX Freedom, to that second tier line, which is now their lowest line as far as I know. Okay, and it also used that 2x7x33. They did this for a couple years, and I stopped recommending the Redfield because you couldn't get it. And I started recommending the Leupold. And then they discontinued the whole line. And they basically decided to be a little bit snobby because they make really good shit. I have to say, they raised the price about $40 when they did that initial move, and it was worth it. They used better glass, better grinding. It was a clearer scope, even though the Redfield was just fine. It was a little bit better, and it was worth $200. It was totally worth it. Well, when they discontinued that, all that's left now is this VX Freedom 2x7x33. Now, this is why I have shot 22s my whole life. I've shot all kinds of 22s, and I've shot a lot of shooting with 10-22 Rugers. This scope, again, all three of them, the footprint, the weight, the balance, it is as if God said, let there be a scope for the Ruger 10-22, and poof, there it was. 7 power will reach out as far as a damn 22 is going to work for the average person, no problems, and 2 is that great low quick acquisition optic that you're looking for. So it is the best choice. I also understand if this is really just a homestead gun for beating around with and taking care of raccoons, that maybe you don't really want to spend that much money. I get it. The problem is no one else makes one like it that I can find. The two closest that I've been able to find, and I have not even put them on T-Spaz because I don't recommend them heavily enough to do so. And just one thing I want to point out is the loophole is 11 ounces. It's very light. It doesn't change the 11 ounces are distributed in a way where it does not change the balance of a 10-22. The best thing I can recommend, the closest thing to the original, is made by Vortex. It's a Vortex Optics Diamondback rifle scope. And it is a 2x7x35. All of these scopes, though, that people make in this range, what they did differently than Leupold is they kind of made the optic on the end where your eye's looking at it, where your adjustment is and all, beefier. And they added weight. In this case, you go from 11 ounces to 14. It doesn't sound like a lot, but almost all the additional 3 ounces are in the optic at the end you look into, right? And it puts more weight to the rear, and the rifle just doesn't balance the way that Ruger intended that rifle to balance when it was first made. It's okay. It's not going to mess it up. You can't blame it for why you don't shoot well. It's just not the same, and I found a thing that I'm in love with, and now I can't find another one, okay? But this is a damn good scope. It's not as clear as the glass on the loophole, but it is damn good for the money. It is almost a replacement for the Redfield and the lower-end loophole. Next on this, another 2x7, 2x7x32. But again, we're talking about too much weight on one side of the scope. 417 grams is a spec. That's right at 14 ounces. You see where this is going? It's the Vantage 2x7 3030 duplex. It's $115. It is probably perfect for you. I'm being a pain in the ass here. I know it. I found my true love for the Ruger 10-22. It's my true love for every 22 rifle, honestly. It is the perfect scope, and these just aren't. But for what you're doing, it'd probably be great. Again, you can go down to a 2 magnification for those closer shots. I would leave it there all the time unless you had a reason to change it. I would zero it there. And this is what I would probably buy if I was Jerry for this application. Okay? My next recommendation is from Bushnell. It's a Bushnell Banner Series. This is kind of their value line. It's a good quality scope, and remember, this is a 22. We're not going to be worried about losing a once-in-a-lifetime shot at an elk because the 338 recoil caused the reticles to start moving on us or something, so it's going to be all right. $112. It's a 1.5 to 4. Now, for what Jerry's saying, this might also be a way to go. Let me tell you what I don't like about it, though. You're going to need, on the 10-22 with this scope, a Picatinny rail, because you're going to need to put the rings a little closer than they'll naturally want to go on the receiver of the Ruger. It's a fairly short scope. You probably could make it work without doing that, but you're going to have problem setting the ocular distance from your eye, right? We all have that on distance that where we throw the weapon up naturally and we have a clear view of the scope. That's not a big deal. But I haven't used this scope, but I have had my hands on it. And just looking at the specs, looking at a 10-22, I don't think it's going to fit with just straight rings thrown on the receiver without it kind of going up on the bell of the objective, okay? So that would be a concern there, just the length, but you know, of the tube that's actually able to have rings on it. I believe this is really made with like ARs in mind, honestly, and it's a great little scope for $112. It's actually in the weight range of the Leupold and the old Redfield, and it's 10.5 ounces. It's actually a half an ounce less. But I'm back to this great big old bell on the eyeball end of the scope, and it just throws the balance off a little bit. It's not bad, though. This would be my top two for Jerry's application would be the Bushnell Banner 1-5 and the Vantage 2-7, both in the $100 range, both great scopes for what they are, and both are going to require, again, probably a Pictini rail on that 10-22 to be able to deal with the length of the tube. The Vantage will need that too. Now I'm going to throw a super cheap recommendation out. Super cheap. It's really not for Jerry because Jerry's already got a rifle with a 4-power scope on it and you don't like it. And I do think some of the technique adaptation will change that for you. But this thing's under $40. I can't not recommend this when asked about 22 rifle scopes. It's a 4-power scope, straight fixed power, which works really great on 22s, honestly. It's a 432. It only weighs 8.6 ounces. It sits beautifully on a 10-22. It sits beautifully on a Marlin 25, a Marlin 60, on anything. You're just dealing with a fixed power scope, which, again, I have no issues with. I think 4-power is pretty damn bang on for 22s. It's made by Simmons. It's called a 22 Mag. Simmons Truplex 22 Mag scope, 4x32. So 32 is your objective, your end that's actually facing out toward what you're shooting at. That's your light gathering end. It is not as good as any of the other scopes. It is not great in low light environments. It only has so much light gathering capability. It does have some parallax, obviously. But it is what it is, right? It's a good scope for the money. I have several 22s with this exact scope on it. I've never had, it's so cheap, and I would just expect them to go bad. I've never had one go bad. It's everything you need to shoot out to. If you can't make a 100-yard shot with a 22 with a 4-power scope on it, you ain't going to make it with a 12-power scope on it. I'm sorry, you're not. It's a good scope for the money. It's also not much money, but it would be something for kind of a beater homestead rifle that some people might find very, very suitable. And the reason that I'll point it out in this discussion is because if I don't, the problem becomes that someone would look at it and say, that's so cheap, it must be junk. They're way better than they have a freaking right to be. I have a little 22 I let my grandson shoot sometimes. It's an old Marlin Cricket, single shot, 22 bolt action. I bought it for my son. I put one of these on it when I bought it for him. He's in his 30s. They still make this thing. Apparently, Leupold, you can keep making stuff for a long time. He had to be under 11 years old, maybe 10, under 10, maybe 9 or 10 years old when I bought him that rifle. And I put that scope on there, and that little freaking rifle will still drive a tack at 25 yards. I mean, you put a tack, I will hit it offhand at 25 yards with this scope. And it's a $40 scope in 2024. I don't understand it. It's better than it has a right to be. So I have all of these scopes with links for you in the show notes today. And if you can tell me your opinion on this, especially if you used the old value 2-7 Leupold, or if you've used the old Redfield, If there is somebody making a scope that's in those dimensions and weight, I would love to know, other than the expensive loophole, the $300 VX Freedom. I want to say one thing about the VX Freedom, not for Jerry, because at his distances, this isn't going to matter. This is it's basically a duplex rectical. It's as they call it, a military rectical. I don't know why. Everybody calls everything military shit. But it's basically a duplex rectical, the top and the left and right of the crosshair. On the drop, it has 1 minute of angle ticks all the way down, and they're grouped in four, and then a bigger one, and then four, and a bigger one. So each of the bigger hashes is 5 MOA. So you can hold over with this, and that is an upgrade over the lower model version. So people that like to play around with stretching the capabilities of the 1022 on range, you're going to love this thing. You really are. And I shot one that was custom built one time, and the guy had ranged it out, and we were shooting prairie dogs at distances. You have no business shooting prairie dogs with a 22 long rifle. Well past 200 yards. And once we kind of got it dialed in and figured out what the wind was doing, it was stupid too easy. So it is a fun scope. It's just a lot of money. I mean, what's the MSRP on a base model 1022? About $350. So you're spending $300 in glass to put on a $350 rifle. And when people are dealing in the 22 rifle range area, they don't tend to think that way, like your glass being pretty much equal in cost to your rifle. But when you want to put the right glass on the right rifle, you're usually in that range. You know, your $1,000 rifles, you're going to be dropping $600 to $1,000 glass on if you really care about what you're building. Now, I have rifles with $40 scopes on them. I have rifles with $1,000 scopes on them. And there's a place for all of this. But I just thought I would give you kind of my take on this. And as much as I like this, I still need an expert council member for guns. JR ain't going to do it. He ain't done it for a long time. He's busy. He's traveling all the time with his job. The problem is, whenever I get somebody that wants to be the gun guy for expert counsel, I'm a SWAT officer, and I did... Look, the tactical stuff, I'm glad you have it. I really need someone that can talk about sporting arms as much as the tactical. I don't want it typecast into that, because we probably get more questions like Jerry's today about guns than we do, you know, I'm looking for a super light trigger for my $4,000 custom AR. I just don't get a lot of questions like this out of this audience. I get a lot more questions about a rifle for deer hunting, getting started hand loading, choosing a round for deer hunting, right? Choosing a load for deer hunting or elk hunting or stuff like that. And it'd be nice to have someone so it wasn't just my opinion. But again, if somebody wants to do that, let me know. TSPC in the subject line. And if somebody has a scope recommendation in this world, and this went way too long, but it's just something I'm passionate about, because I found the dadgone... I mean, somebody somewhere made the perfect scope at a reasonable price and then took it away, and I'm just mad. So I would say, if you can find the old Leupold or the old Redfield in the 227 on eBay or something from a good seller that's not selling you something that's been busted up, you might want to pick one up. With that, I'll go ahead and wrap up for the day. Friday flashback tomorrow. Just here at the end, guys, if you are not an MSB member yet, consider becoming one. Help us out and get your money back with all the great discounts that you get as an MSB member. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that flashback, and Monday we'll start it all over again. Run you around.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.